Good morning. Good morning to the hearty Saturday morning 9 a.m. crowd. Thank you for coming. I'm Kyle Pope. If I can advance this. That's me. I'm one of the founders of Covering Climate Now, which, for those of you who don't know, is a collaboration of about 500 newsrooms around the world that is made up. It's run by journalists for journalists. Our only job every day is to help give journalists what they need to cover the climate crisis. Really happy to be here. I just wanted to give you a little bit of framing on how this conversation came about. And it was sort of like an unexpected thing for us. This began as two separate pitches to SEJ. So Covering Climate Now, Len and I have been working with a lot of local TV stations around the country, helping them figure out how to cover climate for a very local audience. And we'd run across some amazing journalists doing some amazing work for local TV and thought that would be something that would be super helpful for folks here to know how that happens. So we pitched SEJ and said, how about a panel on local TV and climate? Completely separately, our friends at the Pulitzer Center and some other really impressive global organizations pitched a conversation about global collaborations and investigations and what we can learn from them and how those work. And SEJ and all of its wisdom said, those two things should go together. And we're like, we don't see this. But we all got together and we talked and we realized there is a lot we can learn from each other. And there's a lot of ways these things overlap. And there's just amazing work going on all these fronts. So we're really excited to be able to, I've been really thrilled to be able to like hear what everybody's doing. And what we're going to do is we're going to start talking, we're first going to talk about the local TV approach to climate. We've got two amazing TV journalists here to show you some clips, talk about how they do what they do to really connect with a place. And then we're going to hear from our colleagues who are going to talk about their investigations, again, collaborative, global, investigative work. And then we're all going to come back together and talk about what are the threads that run through these things, which is where you'll come in. Really, really interested to hear sort of your questions on both on how this stuff happened and also like what how these things are related. That's almost the end of my job. I just need to introduce our moderators. My colleague Elena Gonzalez is the engagement manager for Covering Climate Now and has been working with me on this TV effort. She helped to build the investigative and podcast unit at NBC Universal Telemundo. And she was previously based in North Africa and has helped cover Afghanistan and Iraq. Marina Walker-Guevara is the executive editor of the Pulitzer Center. Before joining this center, she was deputy director of ICIJ, where she helped lead this amazing coverage of the Panama Papers and the
Paradise
Papers. So I'm going to now turn it over to Elena. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kaya. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for being here early this morning. I work with Kyle, as he mentioned, in Covering Climate Now. And in the past few months, we have been working to help local TV reporters make the climate connection in their stories for a general audience. And we also help them to find climate stories in every bit of the newsroom. And I can assure you that sometimes this is not easy for them. Sometimes they need to convince their editors. And other times, and many times, they need to translate science for a general audience, which is not easy at all. Fortunately, we have here two great TV reporters focused on climate, and both of them, and I'm very happy to say, they have chosen a justice story from different angles. One is from the environmental side, and one is from the climate side of it. So I'm going to stop talking now. I'm going to give them the mic. First, we have Tevin Wooden. Tevin is working with NBC 10 Boston. And please, Tevin, introduce yourself and your story. Thanks. Welcome.
Elena, thank you. My name is Tevin Wooden. I am a meteorologist at NBC 10 Boston. There we go. Now I'm Tevin Wooten officially because it says it on the screen. I'm a meteorologist at NBC 10 Boston. I'm also a climate reporter as well. I do a lot of work on a day-to-day, just presenting the forecast, but month-to-month, week-to-week, I'm researching and doing climate stories. And I like to put an equitable lens on most climate stories because we know that there is a significant sector who is least responsible for the climate crisis, as you find out in the story, but also the most impacted by it. It's very easy, especially in a place like Boston, to stick with a PR pitch or press release or the, you know, thing that may come from a public official. But when you really dig into these stories, a lot of these stories have more meaning and they have more impact on a wider audience. And so this is one story that we did last summer. And I'll just go ahead and let that play, and then we'll talk about it on the other side.
It has been nearly 2 months since Boston Mayor Michelle Wu signed an executive order banning fossil fuels from new city buildings and major renovations by 2050. In tonight's Climate 2023 report, First Alert meteorologist Tevin Wooten explains how public housing is already working to meet even more aggressive goals and improve public health in the process. Tevin joins us in studio with the story. Tevin?
Hi, Corey. The Boston Housing Authority holds one of the largest shares of the city's greenhouse gas emissions. In line with the mayor's executive order, the BHA is integrating low-energy and carbon-free building practices into public housing to reduce emissions and provide a better quality of life for Bostonians who call it home.
We need to rapidly reduce emissions while also bringing back benefits to people who will be most impacted and least responsible for the climate crisis.
With just 7 years until a fossil fuel-free target takes hold, hundreds of Boston Housing Authority units are being converted to climate-conscious apartments with reduced carbon emissions.
What this looks like in practice, it means adding new envelopes outside of buildings, replacing windows, changing from gas boilers to electric heat pumps.
As BHA's Deputy Administrator for Sustainability and Capital Transformation, Joel Wool, says, the Housing Authority has sustainability top of mind for its 10,000 apartment portfolio.
We are moving properties that in some cases were built in the 1930s to try to bring them 90 or 100 years in the future.
In some cases, they're starting from scratch and rebuilding properties like the Ann Lynch Homes at Old Colony, one of the nation's oldest federal public housing developments. Currently, there are three phases of affordable and sustainable housing on site. The first two were completed nearly a decade ago with improved windows and ventilation. The newly constructed phase three is in use today as senior housing and is fully passive, meaning it uses little energy and has a reduced carbon footprint. But the city's decarbonization efforts aren't stopping there. An additional 300 fully passive and all-electric apartments are in the works.
Across the street, we see the next phase under construction right now.
The old colony was far from climate-friendly, but today, its latest facilities are built to passive house standards. The multifamily complex has a strong southern exposure using the sun as a primary heating source. And there's added insulation, too, to maintain the building's internal temperature longer, which could come in handy in a time of environmental crisis.
The most successful passive house projects, you're walking in, and it feels the exact same, regardless of what it is outside.
Under a decade-plus-long public-private partnership between the city of Boston, the architectural team, and managed by Beacon Communities, more than 800 units on this site will be rebuilt, something residents in this South Boston neighborhood are proud of.
I think it builds your esteem to the fact that you've got something beautiful.
You've seen a lot.
Quite a bit.
Good.
Bad. Well, we're in the brick buildings, concrete, and everything. We've come a long way.
Why is it important to take that aggressive action?
We know retrofitting public housing is one of the best, if not the best, ways to reduce Boston's emissions and to reduce Massachusetts' emissions. People who are low income, people of color, and people who are disproportionately impacted by air pollution are some of the least contributors to the climate crisis.
A recent Tufts University study found that more than half of affordable housing buildings in the Commonwealth are within 600 feet of a major road, exposing residents to traffic-related air pollution. So improving indoor air quality and ventilation helps improve overall public health.
What we're doing when we retrofit public housing and when we make it more sustainable is we're ensuring that the people who have been bearing the greatest burdens of the climate crisis can also benefit from the new green future that we are trying to build together.
If we don't get on top of it now, we're not going to have an earth left to live on.
Very, very true indeed. All right, Seven, this has been really eye-opening. But when you think about, you know, those homes, that you think about just the person that they're built for. But what are some of the public health benefits of building green?
Corey, that's a great question. Researchers are actually saying green buildings have brought significant reductions in asthma outcomes for children in public housing. In fact, a 2015 study published in the American Journal of Public Health looked at 188 residents in three Boston housing developments. It included buildings constructed at these green standards, lowered the risk of an asthma-related hospital visit by 76%. It also found that children were less likely to miss school because of asthma by nearly 80%. So, Corey, I think this is certainly what makes this much of a no-brainer. It's climate-friendly, and it's environmentally friendly, too.
Well, great story, right? I would like you, Tevin, to tell us about how did you choose this story? How did it come together?
So the backstory behind this story was that we did a story on a passive, the first certified single-family passive home in Boston, and it was built. There were a trio of houses within the neighborhood, and the house value was, I think, about $1.2 or $1.3 million. So it's great because this person can say, you know, I want to make this investment to invest in my community, to invest in our environment, and that is my contribution to the climate crisis. But the average person, most of us in this room, if not all of us in this room, did not have the capital to put down a $1.2 million investment. And so I wanted to look beyond that because that story specifically, as great as it was, and it was a solutions-based piece, you would miss 95% of the audience who is watching NBC 10 Boston. You would miss 95% of Americans who cannot afford a $1.2 million home. The average annual salary needed to live comfortably in Boston is $124,000 to live comfortably in Boston. The average rent is about $2,600 to $3,300. So again, all of these solutions that we say that people really want to be a part of, they're not equitable, they're not financially feasible. This is a way to really go to, perhaps some of the lowest income individuals in Boston and show how they are a part of the solution and how it can actually be something that you could take the oldest housing authority in the country and make it one of the newest and most sustainable.
And we're going to have some space for questions at the end of the session. But anyway, if you have any question, please raise your hand and I would ask you to identify yourself and make the question. Okay. Tevin, did you find any obstacles doing the story? I know that time is very constraint in TV airtime. This is very hard for us to put together a story in just 2 or 3 minutes and try to tell everything involved. And sometimes editors can receive pushback from your editors. What's your story about this?
Yeah, so we've got a great newsroom at NBC 10 Boston. We also have Telemundo as well in our newsroom. So we're a bilingual newsroom. But I found it very difficult as a climate reporter, as a someone who is a trained meteorologist and also, a degreed meteorologist and a degreed journalist, to work with someone who's not a degreed meteorologist and who's not a degreed climate reporter as well. So there's a lot of friction sometimes that can come about when you have a producer who is so great at their job, they've worked in the industry for so long, but climate journalism is still new and climate reporting is still new to some newsrooms. So you have to, in a friendly way, kind of, you know, propose the friction, push back, because I think in the end, that's what ultimately gets two sides to come together for a much better story.
When you are reporting on climate, do you have any tips for anyone starting in the business?
For anyone starting in the business, I would say find a central character. The one thing that I noticed that all of you did during the story, and I'm so glad you did, you laughed at the little lady who said she's seen the good and the bad. She added just a little bit of flavor, a little bit of context to the story because she had been there at that apartment complex for, I think, about 30 to 50 years. I don't know the exact number off the top of my head. So she's been there a very long time. My journalism professor at the University of Arkansas, way back when, he said, take me there, make me care. I think when you're doing a climate story, it's so easy to get lost in the data. It's so easy to get lost in the numbers. Find a central character because your audience will ultimately care more if they can see themselves reflected or see their aunt, their uncle, their grandparent reflected in the story. Data is great. Let the data be the data and the fact, and then toss in a little, maybe a little opinion, a little flair, a little flavor with the character.
Anyone has any question for Teddy, please?
What's your name? Rocky, nice to meet you. I think the pushback wasn't as extreme as I initially thought it was going to be, especially in a market like Boston where there are a lot of traditionalists or people who have been in the stronghold of the community for so long. But Boston is on the forefront, so I have that working, I would say, to my advantage when it comes to climate reporting and climate storytelling. But in that same realm or that same vein, if you're in a newsroom or a market that is a little less blue, perhaps a little more purple or red, there are climate connections everywhere that all of us care about in a different way, whether it's beer, whether it's sports, whether it's crops, all of these different things that are going on. I like to relate weather to climate because I'm a meteorologist. But all of these things have some sort of connection. So where there's pushback, there's also passion. I think there's concern. And if you can touch on that concern, then you can almost sort of bypass any sort of pushback that you would initially get to remove sort of the discussion out of it. And the second part of your question was,
do you see other local community meteorologists doing these kinds of stories?
I do. And I have the favor or the fortune of being someone degreed in both science and journalism. But I would say to any newsroom that's thinking about having a meteorologist do a climate story, if they're not a trained storyteller, pair them up with someone who is, because you don't want to lose your audience just because you started tossing out data and facts. I do see a growing trend of meteorologists doing more climate stories, which is great because in a newsroom, I am the station scientist. I went through 60-degree temperatures in March in Boston, a nor'easter 2 days ago, and then an earthquake yesterday. And we've got 60s and 70s on the way next week. So people look to us for answers. We have to be there to answer the call and answer the questions. And I love now that people are more naturally curious. They may not say, is that climate change? But they may ask, well, something's going on because it hasn't been like this all the time. We haven't had just 9 inches of snow in a winter in Boston, you know, back in my day is the phrase, but I wasn't back there then. Anyway, there was another question.
There's another question, right?
Pattern. It always comes back to time. I used to work for the Weather Channel actually up until 2 years ago, and I love the work that they do, and I'm fortunate that I get to do that now for the community in Boston. We don't have enough time. 30-minute broadcasts, hour-long broadcasts, even though we have programming for 12 hours a day, there's never enough time. I try to take the conversation and follow it up sometimes online and digital and with these climate reports, because that segued actually into a forecast where I perhaps think at some point throughout the day, we talked about an urban heat island. We get the opportunity to use other sources like Covering Climate Now and Climate Central in our day-to-day reports. There was a great story that aired a couple of months ago, well, last fall and summer, about baseball and how climate change had impacted baseball. Well, if you live in Boston, there's this team called the Red Sox. No matter how bad they are, everyone still loves the Red Sox. So I was able to cover and connect baseball and climate change to the forecast for the upcoming opening day, or opening home opener, as it's called, last year. So I connected at every single point I can. Some days it's easier than others because there's a pretty clear connection. Other days there's not a clear connection. But I think when we have the moment and when we have the opportunity, we have to seize the moment and make that connection.
Yes, last question before we move.
That's a very good question, and I honestly don't know the answer. I know that Mayor Wu has sort of made it her mission to bring the climate crisis to the forefront, but I don't know if she has the backing to make it affordable for everyone. I see things like this happening, which is great, but it's not happening quick enough. Like I said, the individual that bought the house for $1.2 million had the capital to do that, but I don't see it happening quick enough, unfortunately. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. We will have time for more at the end. Thank you, Kevin. Thank you very much. I would like you to know and to introduce you to Ana Bueno. She says, great Univision 45 reported. She's based in Houston. And please, Ana, present your story.
I know that I speak out loud, but probably I'll admit this. Good morning, everyone. So, yes, my name is Ana Bueno, like good in English. I'm an environmental reporter for Univision 45. We're a Spanish outlet. I was raised in Veracruz, Mexico. We're right in the Gulf. And this month will be 2 years since I moved to the United States, specifically to Houston, Texas, which currently ranks as the fourth largest metro area in the country, and its Hispanic population grew in the last couple of years, actually, around 45% of the city. More than approximately 2.3 million residents are Hispanic, according to the Houston Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. I remember that one of my first interviews was with Dr. Robert Bollard, and I remember he mentioned that America is segregated, so is pollution. And he isn't, and he wasn't wrong. Sadly, and it's not a surprise for any of us, that the Black, Brown, and Hispanic communities are the most impacted when we talk about pollution and climate change, which is segregates or exacerbates, even more the issues that we already have. As you can tell, and we can see where the white community is, where the Hispanic community is, the Black and Brown community, and all the dots, it's all the pollution. So it's a reality. The story that you're about to watch was born as a collaboration with Public Health Watch, a nonprofit, nonpartisan investigative news organization that focuses on threats and injustices in communities' health and policies. And actually, here's one of the journalists that I had the opportunity to work with, which is David Leffler, and it's here. So the story takes place in Channel View's Jacinto Port neighborhood, which over the years transformed from being a rural enclave to an industrial center because of Houston's lax zoning. This community is constantly breathing dangerous levels of benzene, which is linked with leukemia, with other blood cancers, and recent studies linked with diabetes and reproductive problems too. And as you can see, this community's cancer rate is twice the national average. And for nearly 20 years, the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality knew about this and it allowed the company responsible for the emissions to expand. So this is a story ain't just about environmental justice, but it's about language justice too.
Cuando llegamos a Channelview era un paraíso. Los venados, los bosques, y después del huracán de Alicia, cuando empezaron a venir más de las empresas, todo eso empezó a cambiar mucho.
Channelview es una zona en Jacinto Port que en los 80 se convirtió en el lugar idóneo para la expansión industrial, exponiendo a la comunidad a elevadas concentraciones de sustancias químicas tóxicas como benceno. En 2019, datos de la EPA revelaron que el riesgo asociado de cáncer en Channelview es de 60 en un millón, 50% más que en el condado Harris y el doble que el promedio nacional. Esta es una investigación en colaboración con Public Health Watch. El benceno es más común de lo que imaginamos, siendo una de las 20 sustancias químicas más usadas en los Estados Unidos y parte de la economía de Texas desde 1901, ya que es uno de los componentes principales de la gasolina y sirve para producir plástico, solventes, adhesivos, pinturas y detergentes, una sustancia esencial para la industria petroquímica del estado. Al ser incoloro y de un olor dulce, puede pasar desapercibido, mas no para los instrumentos de medición.
The area that we live in is the most monitored area in the United States. And we have a network of monitors like the one behind me and are run by the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, and they measure different things. The number of monitors that we have that measure benzene is between like 8 and 9 monitors of benzene. And they're really in areas where we see a lot of industry. And we're concerned about it because benzene causes cancer. When we compare the concentration that is in Channelview for benzene to the concentrations in all the surrounding monitors that measure benzene, it's the highest concentration. So it's totally the place we need to focus.
Y así fue en el 2005 cuando un 4 de junio, Tim Duddy, ex científico de la TCEQ, quien lideraba el equipo móvil de monitoreo de aire, tomó las primeras lecturas en Channelview y los hallazgos fueron alarmantes, especialmente aquellos provenientes de la compañía Kaysoft, como le indica este documento, y es una compañía dedicada a la distribución de químicos.
It was concerning, right? Hundreds of parts per billion by volume of benzene in the Jacinto Port neighborhood that we were measuring. So much that, you know, we were using respirators back in the day and had those available to us. And at the time, access to an infrared camera. There was hydrocarbon coming out the top of the tank. It was right next to, adjacent to the roadway. I guess the one thing that was remarkable is really the distance from the actual facilities, how close it is in vicinity to the general public. Hundreds of feet, right? I mean, it was literally across the street was the closest neighbor. We interacted with the public on the streets. They indicated that, you know, odors were prolific around the industries and that they were affected by them.
En la actualidad, la TCEQ considera que el público está protegido si el aire en el exterior de las instalaciones industriales mantienen una concentración de benceno de 180 partes por cada 1,000 millones de partículas de aire en promedio por hora. Eso es 7 veces más elevado de lo que el Estado consideraba seguro en el 2005.
There's been elevated benzene concentrations in that neighborhood for years. The TCEQ has known about them since at least 2006.
It's failed. Muy feo. Me disturba mucho.
La familia de Randy vivía aproximadamente a escasos 70 pies de Kaysoft por 20 años hasta que le vendieron su propiedad para que se expandiera. Su padre falleció de insuficiencia renal provocada por la diabetes en el 2004. Su madre, a pesar de haber vencido el cáncer de tiroides, necesitó ayuda de un respirador hasta el final de sus días, mientras que Joel, el mayor de sus hermanos que la cuidó hasta el 2017, fue diagnosticado en el 2013 con mielodisplasia, un tipo de cáncer de la sangre que puede derivar en leucemia, además de complicaciones por la diabetes como problemas digestivos y pérdida de visión, motivo por el cual no pudo brindar una entrevista a Univision 45. Aunque no hay estudios que vinculen directamente las afectaciones de la familia de Randy con la contaminación local, varios estudios señalan que la corta exposición a benceno puede tener repercusiones inmediatas en la salud, como vómitos y mareos. Una exposición prolongada puede causar leucemia u otros tipos de cáncer, y recientes estudios lo vinculan con la diabetes y problemas reproductivos.
¿Siempre crees que el gobierno o el ley o las reglas te van a proteger? Y nada de eso pasó. Cuando me estás diciendo que todo esto estaba pasando, es increíble, increíble.
Esa fue la misma sensación cuando platiqué con Kristen Menifee, el abogado principal del condado Harris.
This appears to be one of the most egregious examples of benzene emissions in a community. And what worries me the most is that our governmental regulators, the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, is just not doing its job.
Por medio de una solicitud de registros públicos, Public Health Watch obtuvo cientos de documentos del estado, incluidos los memos toxicológicos y los reportes emitidos por el equipo de Dottie. De acuerdo con el reporte del primer viaje, en el 2005 los científicos realizaron aproximadamente 80 horas de monitoreo del aire cerca de las viviendas situadas con el viento proveniente de la instalación. Encontraron docenas de químicos, sin embargo, el benceno era su prioridad. Durante su investigación, el equipo registró un promedio de 23 partes de benceno por 1,000 millones durante un periodo de 18 horas. Hoy, K-SOF está legalmente autorizado para liberar casi 20 veces más componentes orgánicos volátiles que cuando comenzaron a monitorear la calidad de aire de la zona, y se trata de un tipo de contaminante que incluye al benceno. Desde que K-SOF inició operaciones en el 2004 y el equipo de Dottie detectó sus elevadas emisiones de benceno en el 2005, la TCEQ los multó hasta febrero del 2006 al descubrir que la empresa aliviaba sistemáticamente la presión de sus depósitos de productos químicos directamente al aire en lugar de pasarlas por controles de contaminación adecuados por $4,320, además de ordenarles la instalación de nuevas válvulas para aliviar la presión de sus tanques. K-SOF realizó el pago y los ajustes necesarios. Los monitoreos en la zona continuaron y en abril del 2006, los científicos midieron una concentración media de benceno en una hora de 180 partes por cada 1,000 millones de partículas.
That's very bad. That's a very high level.
En aquel entonces era 7 veces más elevado de lo que la TCEQ permitía, que eran 25 partes por cada 1,000 millones de partículas. En el 2007 ardió un camión cisterna cargado de xileno en las instalaciones y K-SOF no fue ni multado ni penalizado por ello, ya que, de acuerdo con la TCEQ, no fue tan excesivo. En el 2021 ocurrió un incidente en el área de almacenamiento químico y K-SOF fue multado pagando una cantidad de $11,413. Las visitas de manera proactiva a Channelview por parte de la TCEQ aparentemente han ido disminuyendo con el tiempo.
You know, I would hope those concentrations would have been reduced by now. So it seems to be in question to me whether the agency's actually done appropriate follow-up in the last 15 years or so.
Solicité una entrevista a K-SOF y en su declaración menciona lo siguiente. K-SOF ha sido miembro de la comunidad de Channelview desde hace mucho tiempo y se toman muy en serio la seguridad. Siempre han monitoreado sus emisiones en conjunto con las regulaciones de la TCEQ, señalando que nunca los ha citado por rebasar el límite de las emisiones de benceno permitido por la agencia, y proporcionaron un número al que la comunidad puede comunicarse en caso de estar siendo impactado negativamente por ellos. Por su parte, la TCEQ se negó a otorgar tanto una entrevista como una declaración por escrito. Le invito a que escanee el código QR que está apareciendo en este momento en su pantalla para leer la investigación de Public Health Watch en español sobre el tema. Para Univision 45, Ana Bueno.
I know that it was more like in a movie, and this piece was for our digital version, and we have to cut it just a bit for being aired, and I promise that I just printed the papers that I needed for the yeah, because I saw that when I was with the boxer, and was like, whoa, I was like, no, I didn't print every single one. But this call-up was very important because over the years, the community transitioned from being majority white to a majority Hispanic, which means that there's people who don't know about this because they don't have access to information in their own language. So according to the U.S. Census surveys, some residents, predominantly from Latino neighborhoods, have limited English proficiency. This map is from the 2018. This may or may not have changed because, as you know, thousands of immigrants arrive annually to this country, and some are, like, switching for one city to another. So the community that is being directly impacted is not receiving the critical information to act properly. So this story wasn't available only in Spanish through Univision 45. Public Health Watch made this huge effort to translate the story as well and making it available for the impacted community. This is the English version, and that's the Spanish version. So at the end, you saw the QR code, so that will link you directly to this because of TV timing. Sometimes we have to cut a lot of information that is really precious. And then just to wrap this up, I want to take a look to this. This is an analysis from Pew Research, and they interview almost 12,000 U.S.-based journalists who were in the news industry in 2022. We can appreciate how journalists' bids vary somewhat by race, ethnicity, and gender. Only 6% of the journalists that cover environment and energy identify as Hispanic or Latino. However, the survey doesn't specify whether their coverage is in English or is in Spanish. So somewhat that I have learned with every single story, like the one that you just saw, is that we cannot talk about environmental justice without language justice, without making the information access. And people that need information the most cannot access it, nor raise their concerns. So definitely, language, it starts to be a key when we talk about environment. Thank you.
Thank you, Anna. I have a couple of questions regarding how is to report for Hispanic audiences, but I will leave it to the end. I would like to pass the floor and to have Marina and her team to expose their part. Thank you.
Hello, everyone. Thank you so much to our colleagues here. I'm really inspired. And we are now going to go to the global outlook, right? The reporters that you're going to hear next are journalists who are working on critical ecosystems in Latin America that are under criminal and commercial assault, for example, the Amazon rainforest. So they are focusing, they are doing local stories, but they are connecting those local stories with the global forces at play, with the supply chains, with the consumers in China, in Europe, in the U.S. They are following the money, they are following the corruption, and they are following the commodities as they travel around the world. I am very inspired by their work. I hope that you are too. Work at the Pulitzer Center, which is an organization that empowers and enables this kind of reporting. And we have been so fortunate to work with Sasha Chevkin, as well as Carla Mendez. And Eduardo is a good partner and friend. Eduardo works at the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project, which is also a global organization that fosters this kind of reporting that you're going to hear about today. So we're going to start with Sasha Chevkin, who is a senior reporter at The Examination, which is a new nonprofit organization focusing on public health. And he's also a Rainforest Investigations Network fellow at the Pulitzer Center. So why don't you take it away, Sasha?
Should I stay here? Or?
Okay.
Hi, everyone, and thank you, Marina. Marina has introduced me in the work I do. I'm going to be talking about two stories that I did with the Rainforest Investigation Network that revealed deforestation in global food supply chains. And These stories highlight very different investigative techniques for showing these deforestation exposures. One was heavily reliant on trade data, while the other was based more on the ground reporting and satellite images. So the first of these stories was published with the Associated Press, and it showed how an American meat broker called PMI Foods was fueling deforestation in the Amazon by shipping more than $1.7 billion of Brazilian beef out of the country, much of that beef coming from suppliers that were connected to deforestation, including illegal deforestation. And what was unique about this company is it was a middleman in the global beef trade, which was a type of actor that had not previously been scrutinized. Okay, is this better, everyone? Okay, great. Sorry. Thanks, everyone. So a key source that I used sort of for the backbone of this story was a commercial trade database called Panjiva that's based on customs export. And what that database allowed me to do was to trace the exports by this company, PMI Foods. And it works through something called HS codes. Every type of product has an HS code. So, for example, frozen beef is 0203. And then there's dozens of other codes that correspond to other kinds of beef products. So one of the things you have to do is figure out what the codes are associated with your products. We also had to figure out all the subsidiaries of PMI Foods that were involved in these shipments. And we analyzed the destinations and the suppliers. And the suppliers for PMI Foods was what allowed us to demonstrate that the company was, in fact, fueling deforestation. One of the really interesting things that we saw about PMI was that more than 95% of its exports from Brazil were going to China. So all those little red cows you see there on the graphic are going to China. And, you know, on the one hand, that's very interesting in itself. It also shows how global the supply chains that are fueling deforestation are. And that when you have beef from Brazil being shipped to China, there's still this American company based in Salt Lake City, Utah, that managed to profit from it. I also used another data source called Comtrade to show that what PMI Foods was doing was part of a bigger story. There has been a huge surge in demand for beef in China over the last decade. The yellow that you could see on that graph is Chinese demand for beef. And the blue is the amount of that beef that's coming from Brazil. And experts told me that the surge of demand for beef from China was a key driver of deforestation in the Amazon. So again, this American company was profiting from a much larger trend that was critical to much of the deforestation that occurred over the last decade in the Brazilian Amazon. Now, some of the responses to this story, PMI had said, well, we rely on our suppliers to follow local laws. And I spoke to Daniel Azeredo, who's a Brazilian prosecutor who has overseen the beef industry, and he said that is not good enough. He said anyone in this supply chain is responsible for making sure that they're not exposed to illegal deforestation. And PMI Foods, when we started inquiring, announced a bunch of steps that they were taking. They joined a bunch of industry working groups to improve sustainability. They also planted 10,000 trees in the Amazon and said that they were going to plant 1 million more. I think there's maybe a follow-up story to do one day if they actually follow through on these promises. But at the very least, they acknowledged that they had a problem and that even as a middleman in this supply chain, they were responsible for doing better in avoiding deforestation. The other story I'm going to talk about was published with Mangabe and Reporter Brazil, which is a Brazilian investigative outlet. It was about the Chinese state-owned food importer, Cofco, and how it was exposed to deforestation in its soy supply chains. And this story relied much more on the ground reporting and satellite images for the key evidence that I used. The most important things to know about COFCO are, one, that it's, you know, this huge company that has made these very high-profile environmental commitments, but also that it is key to China's food security, and it's a strategic state-owned company. China has 1.4 billion people, and it can't grow enough food to feed them, so it really needs the soy and the palm oil and the other commodities that COFCO is importing. Our data led us to a soy producer named João Luis Lazzarotto, who our data showed was a COFCO supplier and had violated something called the soy moratorium, which was a voluntary pledge by companies, including COFCO, not to buy soy that came from land that was recently deforested. And so I went to COFCO's fazenda, like his farm and plantation, to ask him about this. And I was worried he was going to kick me off his property or yell at me or worse. But it turned out that he openly admitted to all these things. He said not only that he had deforested the area, but that COFCO was great because they were continuing to buy from him even after he had deforested while other companies had stopped. And he told me the soy moratorium was unjust because Brazilian law allowed him to deforest those areas, and that he had another 350 hectares on his property that he was getting ready to deforest soon because the law allowed him to. So, again, I just showed up at his property, and he basically gave me this crucial evidence for my story. I had thought that the story was pretty solid then, but it turned out that when we then went to COFCO and presented this evidence to them, they denied that they had purchased from Lazzarotto, again, even though he had told us this. And what they claimed was, you know, you could see on one of these properties that there's that big chunk that has been deforested. And what COFCO claimed was that because two sections of the farm were registered as separate parcels in the Rural Land Registry in Brazil, that they actually were different farms. And so COFCO said that it was not exposed to deforestation because it bought from the upper half of Lazzarotto's farm instead of the lower half. Now, we had to then use satellite images to show how bogus that excuse was. And if you look closer at these images, you could see, you know, not only that there was an area clearly deforested after the cutoff date for the soy moratorium, but that if you look at that central strip, there's no fences, there's no roads, there's no boundaries. It's all one contiguous property. And if you look towards the top, you could see that there's only one area with grain silos in the top area of the farm. So it is literally nonsensical for COFCO to claim that they weren't exposed to the grain that was grown in the bottom half of his farm because there was nowhere else that it could possibly have gone. And so that was the evidence that we relied on for this second story on COFCO. So to wrap it up, three reporting tips if you are looking into deforestation in global food supply chains. One is to talk to people who are deforesters or alleged deforesters. You know, there may be cases like Carla may be talking about where there are very violent actors who you need to be careful of. But in many cases, there are people who will talk to you and their version of reality will be so different that they will openly confirm important parts of your story. Another is to prepare for legalistic, hair-splitting, absurd denials of responsibility, particularly for big corporations, and to think about the kind of evidence you'll need to refute those. And then finally, just to recap some of the key sources I used, Panjiva for export data, Comtrade for global trade data, so at a country-to-country level, and then finally Planet Explorer for the satellite images used in the last story. So I'm going to leave it there.
We're going to keep going, but please think and write your questions for the speakers. Thank you so much, Sasha. Another thing I was thinking when I heard Sasha is we focus sometimes so much on like what is illegal when it comes to environmental crime, but what about what is legal corruption? What is legal crime, like the case that you just mentioned, and how we go about investigating that. The next speaker is the wonderful Carla Mendez. Oh, no, sorry, we're going to go first with Eduardo, right? Yes, yes. Carla is like the golden ending. Eduardo, as I said, is an editor, the Brazil editor at the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project and Investigative Journalism Network.
Hi guys, good morning. My name is Eduardo Goulart, the Brazil editor at OCCRP. I'm also SEG Diversity Travel Fellow, and thanks for that. I appreciate all the help that you guys and effort that you guys made to me to be here. So I have a really broke English, so please be gentle, and if you guys don't understand anything, please let me know. Today, I'm gonna tell you guys about this cross-border investigation that we did at OCCRP related to TIAA, which is an American insurance company that has a billion fund of insurance, the teacher insurance company fund, I mean. At OCCRP, Actually, OCCRP is a global network of journalists that investigate crimes with a transnational perspective. So I'm not an environmental journalist, but I do investigate environmental crimes. And one of the pillars of OCCRP is the collaboration. So we always work with local media. For instance, in Brazil, we have this outlet called Piauí. We always work with them. In this specific story that I will show you, we worked with a Brazilian outlet called Agência Pública and also with an American outlet called Barron's. And they have this financial angle covering. So, it's a story about how TIAA made this joint venture with Cosan, which is a Brazilian multinational company, a huge multinational company that produces sugar. And they also play a key role at Cerrado in Brazil with the soy production and also corn production. And Cerrado is a big savanna in Brazil. It's a local bioma, but with a global importance because it's a huge carbon sink. And the Amazon, which I think everyone knows in the whole world, is a cross-border bioma. And Cerrado is just a Brazilian bioma in several states of Brazil. The thing is, the Cerrado is the new frontier of the Brazilian agriculture production. And last year, the deforestation of the Amazon decreased. In the other hand, the deforestation of Cerrado increased by 40%, and mainly because of the soy product, the soy and the corn production, which is made by in mainly cases made by multinational companies. So we published this story about TIAA and Colson. They bought land from land grabbers in the Cerrado, and were notorious land grabbers. One of them are accused of murders, including murders, and was well known about a simple Google search. If they made a simple Google search, they would know the people that they were dealing with. But we had access. I'll show that. But we had access to internal emails, so we knew that they were dealing with criminals. So this joint venture with Colson and TIA is really related to rural violence in Brazil and also of deforestation. But that's not an exception, because there is this funding, this pension fund, TIAA in Brazil, but also Harvard Fund is also buying Brazilian land. So after 2008 crisis, this kind of funds started buying lands in Brazil because it was really cheap, and they have good profit with that. But it's always related to violence, because in these places live local community that in many cases don't have registries. Deeds?
Land deeds?
Mm-hmm. Registration. Land deeds. So criminals in Brazil just grab their lands and sell to these big companies to have profit. So it has, this kind of thing has a huge human cost. Not only the environmental cost, because as I told you, the deforestation of Cerrado is really linked to this kind of production of the soy supply chain and also the corn supply chain. So many details of this investigation was already known, published by the Brazilian media about corruption of judges, land grabbing. But the main difference of our investigation, that I think it was that we had access to this huge leak with 100 giga of internal information and data from COSAN. And we have at OCCRP this platform, this data platform called Aleph. So we can search and cross-reference data with this tool. And also we are able to cross-reference with other data. So for instance, the owner, the major owner of COSAN is a Brazilian billionaire called Rubens Ometo. So we have this information is publicly known, but we have the elections donors of Brazilian campaign elections. So we have all the donors, so we can cross-reference in Aleph and see that Rubens Ometo is the biggest donor at last year election campaign and the election before that. So he's really, really close to the power. So this is how it looks like the Aleph, and this is the leak or part of the leak. So one thing about Aleph that it can extract entities, and with this algorithm, and its algorithm was made to follow the money. So extract entities like name of people, of companies, of documents, of or emails, and so on. So it's easier to follow the money with that. As we work investigating crimes, it's really important to have security protocols. So I'm specialized with OSINT investigations. So many of my work is related to digital investigations, and we work as a global network of journalists in different places. So we have to use the digital protocol. So Signal, encrypted mails, and we have this week for collaborations. So it's a safer place to keep our information. And to share our investigation with partners such as, here is the OSCRP wiki. So it's a place where we not only keep our information, but we can easily track, what we have and share with our partners from Agência Pública, Barons, and so on. Here is the Rubens Ometo background. So, but beyond the leak and those same techniques, we have also the field reporting. This is Isabella, a freelancer photographer, Junior, our fixer at Bahia, where we went to do the field reporting. And that guy, I don't remember exactly the guy with the sunglasses. Oh, it's me. Here are some photos. Deforestation. That guy is a Bolsonaro supporter and a manager of a farm that produces soy. So there are risks to do the field reporter, as you know. The publication of Barons with more with a financial angle. The publication in Portuguese by Agência Pública. And I think the conclusion is that all this climate changing has this global component. So the food that you guys eat here in US, the coffee that you drink here, most of that are produced in the global south. So the impact of the climate change is global, of course. But the real impact of this kind of production, the trail of blood remains mainly in the global south.
Thank you so much, Eduardo, and now the wonderful Carla Mendes, who is an investigative reporter with Mongabay, also a Rainforest Investigations Network fellow with the Pulitzer Center, and an SEJ board member, will talk to us about the human cost of these global criminal networks and local networks, what Eduardo just called the trail of blood.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for waiting to the end. And as Kyle mentioned, we didn't plan to be doing this together, but I think it came together really connected. Like Anna's last story is really the effects on the human side there in the Hispanic community. And here, I'll dive into my investigation. That's my project as a Pulitzer Center fellow, showing what's behind the violence. Of course, all of you heard about the increasing murders that happen in the Brazilian Amazon and also in the Cerrado, but the Cerrado, internationally, the Amazon ends up being more known, but it's really important that Eduardo showed us about the Cerrado, that's the world's most biodiverse savanna. And so just to give you a little bit of background about my project is that, No. Sorry, I'm getting lost. Yeah. So, this project, actually, it comes back to 2019 when I did a documentary film in Maranhão State in the Brazilian Amazon about the Guajajara indigenous that set up a group a decade ago to protect their land because they are facing increasing incursions of illegal loggers. And then they set up this group. Then I did a documentary film at the time for the Thomson Reuters Foundation. We released the documentary in May 2019. And in November, Paulino Guajajara, one of the guardians I interviewed, was murdered in an ambush allegedly by loggers. And since then, I really wanted to be back. At the time when I did the documentary film, I heard a lot about the timber laundry scheme, that this timber was exported to the other countries. And that was my original proposal to the Pulitzer Center. And then when I got the fellowship in 2023 to be back there, and I went to the ground, and then I figured that the main issue for them became illegal cattle inside the indigenous territory because the timber problem still exists but reduced a lot, thanks in part for the work for their indigenous themselves that are doing the protection of the territory and doing the work that the government and environmental agents should be doing. And that's my upcoming investigation, hopefully by the end of the month it will be published. But then when I was there, I also realized that I really needed to touch on the case of the murder of Paulo Guajajara, who was murdered 4 years ago, 5 years ago now, and nobody was in charge. There was no trial so far of that case. And actually, there is a systematic problem, like the rates of violence in Maranhão and in Araribóia are huge, and nobody has never gone on trial. In the case of Paulo Guajajara murder, it will be a landmark in Brazil because it will be the first murder of an indigenous leader who will go before a federal jury. What that means? Most of the cases are not even investigated, but this case, the prosecutors make the case that it was not an attack only against Paulo's life, but it was an aggression against the entire Guajajara community. So really anxious to see the case being coming to life, and hopefully this year they'll set up a trial. And another thing is that I interviewed Paulo in 2019. The interview wasn't part of the main documentary, and as his interview was really a death foretold. He was telling me about the death, what he was facing, an ambush by loggers there. At the time, we won 4 international awards with that documentary film, including an SCJ one, and I really wanted to follow up on this. So this project really shows the importance of follow up and stories, as we do as journalists, because several times we do a story and then we move on trying to do something new. But it's really important to keep track, especially when there is this human sides. And then we did a new video there that's a 10-minute long. I'm not showing it here. I'll just show you the trailer that's 1 minute, 1.5 minute. And the video of the 10-minute one, the federal prosecutor in charge of the case, we use in the jury. So, like, to me, it's one of the most important impacts we had because to really help to make justice for them. So I will play here. Can I? Okay, here.
Paulo Paulino Guajajara was murdered in an ambush, allegedly by loggers, a few months after we filmed this interview in 2019.
Nossa, senti muito sozinho assim, sem ajuda. Nós estamos precisando de ajuda, muito apoio aqui, né? Essa terra aqui para nós.
Paulo was a target, given his work as a guardian of the forest, a member of a group of indigenous Guajajara who oversee external threats in the Araribóia territory. In August 2023, I got back to Araribóia to talk with Paulo's family and the other guardian who survived the ambush, Laércio Guajajara,
to bring the case into the spotlight again because the crime has not been tried after 4 years.
Some background photos at the time when I went there. The three are all in 2019, and then here you see Paulo showing me even a bullet, because at the time we talked about risks as Eduardo faced. And when I was there in 2019, we followed the guardians destroying an illegal logging camp, and on the way back we heard shots, because of course, there are some indigenous that ended up co-opted by legal loggers and ended up allowing this. And here, it's Paulo's family, his dad, his brother, and here is his kid. That's another very sensitive story, because the mom left the kid. The dad, the grandpa is raising the kid, and the pension is going to the mom. So they're trying to get this. So it's like, yeah, it's really... really touching situation. And this, when I interviewed Laércio Guajajara, who survived by a miracle from the ambush, for this illegal carry story that's upcoming, he told me a lot of things that's going on. And we hiked a high hill there. And when we were there, I was planning to do the interview there, but there was a really loud music from a party from a non-indigenous community. And again, we heard shots coming from there. So, like, for the first time, I used a satellite communicator on the ground. Thanks for Spirits of the Center, we could use the travel budget to buy that. I've been to the Amazon many times, never had it. And it was the first trip that I did to the Amazon after the murder of Don Phillips and Bruno Pereira, that everyone is aware. So all of us really increased the safety protocols to go on the ground. And I said, I have to have this with me. And every day I sent check-in messages like twice, three times a day to Pulitzer Center, to my editors at Monga Bay, because I was in a really remote area, and then we need to be watching people we are working on. Here we see like Laércio, who survived the ambush, here like with the guardians that we followed. And then one thing that I did that, and also touching what Anna said, is about the language. I've been working for U.S. or U.K. outlets since 2017 as an environmental reporter, writing in English. But from the beginning, I said, I have to have my content in Portuguese. How people in my country, they need to know that. Just a very, like, 5% of the Brazilian population really can read in English. And I said, to me, it doesn't make sense. And then I always publish Portuguese and English, sometimes translated to Spanish as well. And talking about the indigenous communities, some of them have difficulty with the Portuguese language. Like the Guajajara, the land is all surrounded by the forested areas, but they preserve the Guajajara language. And I follow them for a week. And, like, it was really beautiful to understand, like, they communicate in Guajajara, and sometimes they said, sorry, I need to talk to Guajajara because otherwise the people won't understand. And, like, reading this long investigations for them is not a thing, but the video has a good interaction with them. That's one thing that you think a lot at Monga Bay, at the Pulitzer Center. Okay, we have this big investigation that we'll keep doing, and is used in court cases and all that, but how can we repack that investigation for certain audiences? Like Eduardo with him, they did like with an outlet and was a business focus and several there. So like it's important to have the traditional one, but it's also to think about ways to have to get the information out for the people we interviewed, and also send them that back to them, the material you do, because in several trips I did, the indigenous said, oh, people come here, talk to me, and we never saw what they published about us. And speaking to now, dear, I think the majority is from the U.S., of course, you publish in English, even you don't publish in other languages, at least to try to get a translation of the material of these communities, you had to give back to them and not do extractive journalism. That's a discussion we had yesterday with Bernard there about education. So, yeah, that's the main things. And thank you.
Thank you, Carla.
Thank you, Carla. Marina.
Thank you so much. I think that one of the conclusions is that there are no real geographical boundaries when we talk about the climate crisis. When we talk about deforestation, there are ecological boundaries, and these are very different from the traditional national borders. And also crime and commerce, you know, they don't know boundaries. They are everywhere. I would like, before we go to your questions, I would like to ask, just give 30 seconds to each of our wonderful panelists to comment on something that they learned from each other as they were listening to these presentations. So what did the local journalists learn or take away from hearing about these global collaborations? What did the global collaborators learn from some of the more local stories that that we heard today, knowing that there's no real separation, that this is all integrated and interconnected? Do you want to get us going, Tevin?
Why not?
Okay.
I first of all, amazing work by everyone on this panel today. I think, like you just talked about, a local or a global story is a local story first. And I think upscaling is something that allows you to connect to not only a local audience, but a global audience too. And so being able to modify your story to fit the audience of the day, but also knowing that you can convert that and sort of piece it together with perhaps another story that then gets you to the next thing. Like, it's all interconnected, not only interconnected globally, but interconnected from a climate crisis standpoint too.
Well, I'm really impressed, and oh my God, you're like such a detective. So I was like, oh my God, they're so brilliant. And yeah, and what Tevin said, like, sometimes we need to, yeah, address locally, but also open up our minds and see what's going on in other places. What I always do at my job is, like, in the case of food, make your question, like, question yourself, what was needed so I could eat this? Because someone else is paying the price. Actually, we are not the ones paying the full price of anything. Clothing, food, mention anything. Someone else is paying the real price, the real cost. I mean, it comes with climate change. We already know that it will be the global south. It will be the most vulnerable people. And that they don't have either the money or the technology for adapt to this. So it was, like, really open-minded, and I think that this is a really good place so we could start collaborating in a global and in a local matter so everyone could have, like, this big vision. And now that you mentioned some of the ways that we can know about deforestation here in the U.S., you can search for Global Watch. Forest Global Watch, that's one. And then there's another nonprofit that is called South Wings. It's in 14 states. It's a nonprofit airplane that with volunteer pilots, they will overflew you, and they will seek for loss of biodiversity, if there are landfills, coal mines. So that's also a way that we could really appreciate and see from other point of view the issues that we have in the land. South Wings, like... No. Here in the U.S., it's in 14 states. Yeah, you can.
And as a journalist, you can reach out to them, and they would do this for free.
Yeah, they're volunteers. So if at the end of the trip you can give something, so they could buy stuff, that's a good way of doing it, and see from another perspective. That's here in the U.S. In case that you need to do something like Sasha made, that it was really impressive too.
Thank you so much. Sasha?
Thanks. So one thing I noticed that both Tevin and Anna did really well was they centered their stories around compelling individuals. And I think that speaks both to your connections to the communities that you report on, but also to your storytelling abilities and the way that you made sure that you connected the bigger story you were telling to people who the audience could relate to. And I think that's something that when we get these very prosecutorial investigations, we could do a little better job of sometimes.
Yeah, I think that the main lesson to me and a great work from everyone here is that, especially for them, it's like every global story is local. And many local stories can be global because the issues happening here in the U.S. are happening in Latin America, happening elsewhere. And so I think it opens up space for collaborative work and in between countries, in between outlet, multilingual publications, because at the end of the day, it's all connected. The climate crisis, the environmental crisis, and then we should really open mind, be more open mind on that. And of course, as SEJ now and the ITR, that's what I'm trying to do, to bring these discussions at a more international level, because several times we just are on our bubble in our neighborhood, in our country, and several, like, the commodities, the food, most of them come from the global south, and people in Europe, U.S., China, they don't know that what's behind is connect to violence and water contamination, and the buyers must be accountable as well. Everyone, not who is buying the products, and it's our duty as citizens to ask for transparency of this information.
Well, I think the main thing about the local news, the local reporting, first of all, is their connection. So even though I was reporting in Brazil, my home country, I didn't know that place, you know. I didn't have the connections there. So when you report in Boston or in Houston, you have the connections. You have your sources already established. And also you know how to do a FOIA. For instance, I know how to do a Brazilian FOIA, but if as a cross-border investigator, I don't know how to do a FOIA in, I don't know, maybe Peru, if I'm doing an investigation about the connection of, I don't know, maybe the logging supply chain in the Amazon, the Brazilian Amazon and the Peru Amazon. I don't know how to do the FOIA. But the main thing is usually investigation stories are kind of boring to read, you know. So you are great storytellers. So I think we, talking for myself, I should try to have more color in my stories with better or spotting light the main characters and bringing some colors to that. Many times I try to do that, but in the end of the day, it's a story to be read by a broader audience. So many times the editor in chief just cut it off all of that. So it's kind of a pain.
Thank you. Yeah, let's not make it boring, please. wonderful tips here. So asking ourselves who's paying the price, who's benefiting and who's paying the price. Define these artificial separations, global and local, and seeing every local story with global connections, every global story first as a local story, and always centering that human face so we can make people care, like Tevin said. It's your turn now to ask anything from the panelists. And thank you, Anna, for, not Anna, Elena.
Hi, everyone. My name is Elijah DeCastro. I'm a Report for America core member. I work in rural South Carolina. And so I wanted to run by something with you all. I'll try to make it short. But basically, in the community that I report on, there's this huge new tire remanufacturing plant. It's going to be a super site. It has $5 billion behind it. And it's from a Vietnamese company, and it's their first time bringing a factory to the United States. And so the community that I report in is very impoverished, and they've made, this company has made a lot of job promises and that kind of thing. And there's a lot of public taxpayer money behind it. And there's a, you know, there's this whole side of the story that's in Vietnam, and I've looked into it a little bit. They have, you know, a history of, you know, deforestation and stuff like, you know, what we've been talking about today. And so I just wanted to hear, you know, your thoughts on how local media can connect with these, you know, make these global connections when, you know, our newsroom is very under-resourced. But, you know, there's this huge, you know, it's this huge thing that's going to transform our community. And there's a whole other side of the story on another side of the supply chain.
Great question. So, global collaborators?
Well, I think it's crucial to work with a Vietnamese outlet. They probably will know about potential crimes that this company is facing in Vietnam. How to say that in English?
Vietnam.
Vietnam. So I think it's the main thing, to work with them. And the thing is always about money and power. So follow the money, see their connection with powerful people in Vietnam, of course, here. What are their connections here in the U.S.?
And I would say that just very quickly, OCCRP also, they mentioned the Aleph database. There's a huge amount of documents and data that is openly available. Like if you go to aleph.org, I forgot what the Aleph, or I don't know what the website is, but you should enter the names of the companies or the individuals there, because you may find documentation already there. Also, we have a Vietnamese investigative journalist as part of the Rainforest Investigations Network, so if you get in touch with me, I will put you in touch with Bao, and that can be a good collaboration.
Just to add regarding funding, while Pulitzer Center have rolling funding for investigations and stories, usually mostly, so like on a year basis, so like you can, I see, especially if you think about global stories, there are a lot of opportunities of grants and fellowships you could apply. Monga Bay is a 25-year-old outlet that reports on environmental issues all over the globe, like except Peaches, we have a huge network of contributors. So, like, if you're interested, I can also give you my contact. And, like, I think there's several ways to, and we have a lot of people working in Asia as well. And I thought about Bao exactly. So, yeah, I think that the good thing of thinking about local to global, there are lots of opportunities of funding.
Next question.
Hi, good morning, everyone. Thank you. My name is Erica Aisi, a freelance journalist. I actually live in Worcester, Massachusetts, so I watch you in the mornings, but thanks for the news. But I'm most of my work is in Ghana, West Africa, and a two-time Pulitzer grantee, so thanks to the Pulitzer Center for sending me to Ghana and Cambodia for a global and local story looking at hair extensions. So my question first is a comment for Anna, just your use of video. I really loved your use of video. Sometimes with environmental stories, they're long, they're print, and they can be boring, but your report wasn't boring at all. I loved your stand-up with your stack of papers, and you walked in and looked like, yeah, she did her research. She means business. And then when you highlighted in pink the data that you were going to use, and it matched with your words that you were saying, I think those are really important to the viewers. And the use of sound when you push the data forward to the viewer. So I really thought that was really important. So thank you. My question to you is, any connection to real estate in that area, whether it's mortgages or rent, is the rent lower to appeal to a certain community, or mortgages lower to appeal to a certain community, and also to steer maybe an affluent community away where a lower income community would want to stay there? So I have questions about that.
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you. And actually, yeah, everyone has something to do with that walk in the the box. That was one of the feedbacks. And I highlighted with the documents because we have this set in Mexico, like, no me lo saco de la manga productions, you know, like the leaf. So you're not pulling it out just because. So for me, it was very important. And for the legal department, it was really important to show the part that it was real, that the document was there and I wasn't lying or altering anything. That's one. Now, considering Houston, the map that I show where you can see the race and toxicity related, when I arrived, one of the best books that I read that allowed me to understand the city was Invisible Houston. So I was reading about red and green lining. For me, that was pretty new 2 years ago. Now it makes total sense. So this type of places, when we talk about that we receive a lot of immigrants every single day, they do not know the area. So they will buy what is affordable for them to buy. There's another story that I did when I first arrived that it was regarding creosote, that is this substance that is for treating the wood so it won't get like old rot or anything. And now this community of Heathworth that has been historically black and brown community, now they want to go and find a way to relocate, but it's like really complicated because when we think about, okay, let's relocate these people, but what we do not consider is that when they will be moved, they become an outsiders because they're being moved to a community that they don't know, right? And in the case of Houston, actually, there's a story that I want to do in collab now with another outlet, because something that happens when you're an Hispanic or a Latina reporter is that the industry and the agencies will always find a way to use, you know, like, oh, she won't understand my answer. She won't do the proper following up. And sometimes you get underestimated. So collapse in this type of cases are really, really important and crucial for understanding and getting the answers. So now there's a lot of people that is starting to do these websites or apps that will allow people to know what type of pollutants are on that site so you can probably buy it or not. But that's the thing, that the information is not there. And as a newer, you will go to whatever is affordable and you will see probably on the first day that you arrive that it is beautiful, that it's probably green, that, you know, and also when we talk about weather, that actually I work a lot with weathermen because I'm always asking them about, okay, so what happens with this chemical when it's a warm temperature or when it's raining or when it's cold, you know, all the chemicals work differently depending on the weather. So they might not smell anything under certain conditions. So that makes even harder till they figured out this big issue. Now they cannot move because they don't have enough money because probably all their savings went there. And now who is going to buy something that it's in a polluted site? And the worst part is that our politicians doesn't have an answer. And they could say, yeah, we're going to relocate and we need money. Yeah, but who is paying? If the company says, I just bought it. The previous owners were the ones who did this mess. It's so easy to just wash your hands. I hope I answered it. So.
Hi, Ruth Dussault. Is this on? Hi, I'm Ruth Dussault with Bay City News in San Francisco. And I'm also a recent graduate from UC Berkeley's School of Journalism, the Graduate School of Journalism 2023. And I'm impressed. I did like Anna's project. And if you did get on one of those planes and flew down Buffalo Bayou to Bay Point, you would see a petroleum landscape that you would never believe. So you've got plenty of reporting to do.
I got
you know, yeah. I've taken a boat. The I want to say every one of you are incredibly impressive, and the you're basically doing a corporate accountability reporting, and I'm bowled over. And it's the most vital stuff to do. And I just want to compliment you very much at first, because what I'm about to say is going to be different. And I have, all of it was people-centered. All of it, I did not hear anything about the climate. I didn't hear anything about the environment. And I had a dilemma, because I had a graduate thesis that was global and extremely local in the U.S., and I was encouraged to go to the Pulitzer Center by my professor to get a grant. But the first thing you do to apply is you look at the last, look at former awardees, and they're all about people. They're all very human-centered. My project was, I had done a national survey in the U.S., and I found rights of nature laws in local charters, in rural townships of people who were both Democrat and Republican, who did not want a fracking well or did not want their water taken from their spring or did not want something. And so it still was corporate accountability. And then I was, of course, it's in the national constitutions of Ecuador and New Zealand. So everyone was saying, go to... go to the Pulitzer, but I didn't have a corpse. I didn't have a human victim right away. There were a lot of human victims in these small townships and everything. So I was wondering why not center? I guess it would be sort of a sea change to consider nature as a sort of a cohabitant or a co. Citizen as opposed to a permittable expenditure. And you're all reporting on nature as a resource. Sorry.
I used to be an
art professor, so I'm very...
I would just say quickly, I would also be interested in what Kyle has to say, maybe, as an assistant editor. The human harms are just so evident in every story that it's hard to leave them out. But I think as my colleagues maybe respond to this, I think we have many examples where they have been, like, the stories are more science-based. And I'm happy to send you like a few examples maybe later. So I just want to encourage you to apply and make your case and explain like what is the angle that you think needs to be centered and why maybe humans in your story aren't the center, if that's the case. That's interesting. Of course.
I would like to say something. I think it's important to also listen to the stories of the people, because remember that inaction ends when it's affecting you. So the inaction, like the climate crisis inaction, it will end till someone is really being affected. But when it's not you the one that is being affected, sometimes it's hard to tell what to do or what will be the next path to do or to continue, right? So I think that when you involve people, it's like, hey, this could be your story too. Actually, we must not forget that the story that we are telling actually is the life of someone else. And probably you could be the next one.
And just to add, in my case, no, because Paulo is the center of my story because of a previous reporting, but like several times we'll find the character when you go on the ground. So like it's not, and as I can tell you, because I was a grantee in the past that I didn't have, I did a big project about Brazilian indigenous in cities and showed this how invisible they were to people. I didn't have any character. I got a grant from the Pulitzer Center based on data. It was a data-driven project. And after analyzing the data and defining the cities that had the highest population, that then I got the people. So like it's really possible to balance that. Like, and there are several data-driven projects and also consider nature and the indigenous people, for example, they consider them as the same thing as the forest. That's why they fight for them, for the nature, because they don't see them separately. I think that vision of seeing nature one thing in us is our vision here. It's not from the local communities.
I would just add that a person in a story doesn't have to be a victim. And, you know, maybe there's a really charismatic and persuasive advocate of right to nature laws, and that could be someone at the heart of the story as well.
Well, I didn't have the time to tell about it, but there is, like, in the Cerrado, the poisoning of the water and the land, and we talked about that in our story, but, you know, we have a short time here to explain. But the thing is, there are several cases, several stories that has not at OCCRP, but I mean in journalism in general, that have animals or the nature as the main character. So I think you should do that. It's really cool to have. But the main thing is why is important, and we always have to have in mind that we are writing to people read, and people usually have more empathy with other people, you know. So, but
I just remembered a project called Super Trees by Vox, and it was supported by the Pulitzer Center, and the main characters are trees. In the specific trees in each of the rainforests are the characters. Okay, next question.
Right, thank you. My name is Erastus Asaridonko. I work with the multimedia group in Ghana, West Africa. And let me say thank you so much to all of you. You've inspired me so much. In Ghana, we have more than 3,000 journalists. Only about 5 of us report on environmental issues. The main issue affecting the country is the impact of illegal mining of gold on communities. Now, it's so pervasive at this point to the extent that all major rivers in Ghana now are highly polluted. Turbidity is running around 500 to 7,000 NTU in many of the rivers. Mongabay helped me amplify one of my stories I did in 2021. So thank you very much. I did a recent one targeting the impact of mining on public health. In fact, we tested samples from all the major rivers, and we recorded high levels of heavy metals, arsenic, chromium, cadmium. And I've been trying very hard to draw the attention of the international community to this, because this is an existential threat. One is affecting agriculture, and cocoa is one of them, because now many of the farmers are using polluted water to water their crops. And we have evidence to that. And so I came here to find out how do we get the attention globally to amplify some of these local stories and to achieve the kind of impact that we want to do to save communities. Thank you.
I feel like you've kind of teed me up here to talk about the examination, which is where I work. We started last year, and we investigate global public health issues with a mission of working with journalists around the world to talk about just the kinds of stories that you're describing. So I would encourage you to find me after the panel and also to look up theexamination.org, because those kinds of stories are what we have a mission of telling on a global level.
And just a reminder, we have a lunch networking table about international reporting. So definitely let's talk, and I'm happy to help and see ideas.
We from OCCRP, we have this regional editor at Africa. So I can pass his contact to you, because if there is a connection with other countries in the supply chain, for instance, or companies from abroad, is OCCRP interest to publish that, you know? And speaking as a Brazilian citizen, is really common in Brazil when we discover a crime, for instance, if there is not related to a transnational company, or if it isn't someone from abroad involved, sometimes the authorities just, shit happened, you know, sorry for my French. And things remain the same. So, for instance, Carla mentioned about the murder of Don Phillips and Bruno Pereira. If it was a Brazilian journalist, it would remain the same, you know? So it was a British journalist, a great journalist. So all the attention of the world went to Brazil. So Brazilian authorities had to do something. So what I'm trying to say is if you can publish your story in other outlet from abroad, maybe the international community will pressure the Ghana authority to do something, you know?
Hi, I'm Sushmita. I'm an independent journalist from India. I'm also a Pulitzer Center grantee and an SCJ Diversity Fellow. So I'm grateful to all of you that I could be here. I had a question, but because this topic was so like relatable to me, I just wanted to say one sentence. Like any story that I work a lot on the forest in India, because India does have a lot of forest mass. And any story on forests in India cannot be a story that does not have people, because people have protected the forest in India. And any climate story, for instance, in developing countries cannot be a story without people, because policies are centered around people. And if people are not protesting, I can't even imagine how a climate story would be if there are no people in it. So my main question is to Carla. I related a lot with your work. So can you share, very briefly in the available time, about the challenges you face with your gender and, you know, all the security issues that come with reporting in the areas that you report? Because I think there's a lack of understanding of, how difficult and how it is to report from these areas.
Thank you. Really pleased to have you here as our diversity fellow. And hopefully next year we have more and more people from other countries. It's amazing having this international discussion. And yeah, talking about risks is really important, because Brazil is so big, as is your country and several countries, and we as journalists go to report on areas, very remote areas, places we've never been. This case that I came back is the only place I came back to report on, and still I went to a different part of the indigenous territory because it's big. And to think about, there is a lot of things that need to do. I think that doing a really good pre-reporting before going on the ground to understand who are the main actors in the area, have a good guide so we can be prepared, even for some things that now, as I'm working on this for many years, I do automatically, but I've been also mentoring some young journalists going there. And just to give an example, okay, you go to the Amazon, there was water there. People drink water mainly from the river, but we are not used to that. So I always buy the purifying pills with you. And I have a friend who went to the Amazon for the first time, talked to me, and she said, it saved my life, because there was this huge drought. Their boat was stuck in the middle of the river. And so there are a lot of steps from preparing your trip, having good contacts, working, as I mentioned, the satellite communicator was the first time that I used. And when the tragedy of the Bruno and Don murder, I knew both in Brazil. It's everyone was really heartbroken about this, and we started thinking more about the security. And when I first went to the Amazon, I didn't think about it. I was afraid, and then I just thought about risks that I took in the past, that hopefully nothing bad happened, but now I'm much more cautious. So it's really, really important to think about it. For this trip, for example, that where I would stay in a different area, it was like 1 hour, 1 hour and a half away from the main town. And then I was debating where to be safer, to stay in the village or in the town. And then I talked to the federal police. And then the federal police say, stay in the village with the guardians. You are much safer because the town is a town of illegal loggers and you are investigating them. So it's really important to spend some time to understand the area, talk to reliable sources so you can be prepared for the things and have an editor, someone checking in with you. And like we do a very thorough risk assessment. But you have to answer a lot of questions. Okay, in case something happens, your contacts of emergency, you have like a secret word or secret phase in case of kidnap or anything to make sure that you are you, that people are not pretending that have you as a that they kidnapped you or something like that. Yep, thank you.
Anybody else? Questions?
Hi, Rocky Kistner, freelance and SCJ board member. I'm hoping we can maybe end on a positive note that you're just incredible reporting on everybody's part. But what positive things have come out of your reporting in addition to shining a light on the huge problems? But have you seen any changes and do you expect any?
I'll say one of the biggest positive changes that I've seen, and you, I think you actually asked the question earlier about how other newsrooms and other local meteorologists and climate reporters have shifted. One of the biggest things that I've seen is, you know, when TV was first a thing, the medium of TV was first becoming a thing, the Nielsen rating boxes were not given to people who look like me. Therefore, the stories that were not told to people who look like me. The story pitches were not about people of color. And so one of the things that I love that we're doing now more and more is not only are we educating our newsroom, we are talking to a different audience. We're pushing the ratings aside. We don't care what, you know, the numbers at 5 o'clock look like, because at the end of the day, our job is to be a storyteller. And I think a lot of the stories that have been neglected in the past are now the stories that are in some instances getting better ratings because people actually care now. We're not beholden to a corporate structure. So that is the change that I've seen in an indirect way to answer your question.
Okay, well, first, before I forget about this, Ghana Environmental Reporter, I remember you asked about the minerals. There's a journalist here that she actually was at the workshop number 3 that is covering the energy transition. She talked about clean energy. So her name is Yael Holzman, J-A-E-L-H-O-L-C-M-A-N. And maybe you can get in touch with her because she's covering the illegal mineral extraction. So that's a way also to make a collab. And now that I can keep with my life with this, one of the things that I've seen with the Latino community is that now they become more proactive, but we have to be careful with the way that we're covering environmental justice with Hispanic and Latino community. Why I say that? Because every single one of us lives in a completely different context, right? And sometimes we are in a very privileged position. When it comes with the Latino, we know that they may have their documents or they may not. And that's difficult. Because there was another story about this community that they owned the surface rights, but they didn't own the mineral rights.
And it became an issue because one pipe just broke, right? So when they started like approaching to us, there were only two medias that were covering, two outlets. One was one in English, that it was KPRC, and the other one was Univision for the Hispanic communities. And it took like a lot of months. People was harassed, was arrested. Some of them got issues with migration till the point that they didn't want us to keep on talking about it. Or they didn't want to give us an on-camera interview anymore. So we have to really be companions. And sometimes we have like this traditional way of doing journalism and just stay in the line. But I will ask you, why should we? There's a moment of the story that you cannot just inform, but also you have to be really sensitive, really respectful, and really empathic. So things that I've seen that is good is that even though they know their conditions, they are willing to say something because there's someone that is understanding their own language. And they know that you'll be there for them. You know, so I think that's something good that I've seen. And another is that the nonprofits have this issue that they don't know how to connect with the Hispanic community. And now I have been working with a lot of them, and it's like quite impressive how they are like, now we can be able to talk with them, to tell them to just put some air monitors in their community for being aware about air pollutions because you made this a story in Spanish. So that's something good about now outlets, small outlets, start putting some money on environment and climate topics.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. I think a positive development has been a growing awareness of the urgency and the nature of the problem of global deforestation. And I think that not only are major news outlets understanding that this is a story that needs to be told, but they're also understanding that it's not just an environment story, but a business story, a crime story, an economic story, and one that touches on so many facets of our society. I honestly think that Rainforest Investigations Network is a huge reason for that. I very occasionally would see deforestation investigations before RIN started. There was one stretch, I think sometime last year, where we're in a space of maybe 4 days, there were big deforestation investigations in Bloomberg and ProPublica, and I think the New York Times, all in 3 or 4 days about completely different topics. And so I think there's growing awareness of this topic and how multifaceted it is.
Yeah, to me, although most of the time we're talking about problems and climate change and environmental issues, but it's really good to see this widespread awareness and coverage. I remember when I started in 2017, for Thomson Reuters Foundation, doing environmental stories. Like, Reuters basically had the environmental stories that the foundation produced and went in the wire, and then we had a change in government, and Bolsonaro just dismantled the environment there. In Brazil specifically, all the other outlets started to cover the environment. And I think that here with the Trump administration and a bunch of things started happening. And I think that a good thing is that we are giving voice to minorities and the problems that are happening, specifically like in case that I cover the most, the indigenous voices. We see stories about them everywhere. And then also with the more accessibility to internet and mobile phones. We are in touch with that community. So like things that happen there, we know. Last year, by the way, when I was arriving in Boise, there was an attack in an indigenous territory where I did a Palmo investigation. They started sending me WhatsApp messages and things. And I literally wrote the story during the conference and through WhatsApp talking to them. So like now, things are not uncovered because they have this direct channel. So it's really important to have this network of trust with reliable sources so we can immediately report on this and take action about this.
Well, about this specific story about TIAA and COSUN, I think the biggest impact was that a financial outlet brought this story to U.S., you know. But real-life impact, I'm kind of pessimistic, you know, because people are still dying. People of local community is still having their own land grabbed. So I think there are a little few stories that we as journalists publish in the press that have real impact. Carla has this story about her work was showed in the jury. So it's a real life impact. But in most cases, there is no real impact, you know? So I don't know. I don't want to put you down, but I think I'm kind of pessimistic with that.
But we play the long game, right? We stay with the stories and we stay with the people, and eventually change happens. Okay?
No, just to add, I would just say that, no, I'm more positive about impacts. Although the stories are sad, like as this case, the trial will happen still and it will be used, but I had other two investigations I did into palm oil that were used in court cases. In one of them, the company had their RSPO sustainable certificate suspended. So like because of the investigation and the certifier coded investigation. So I keep the hope. And there was also all other impacts. For example, there was this project that I did for the Pulitzer Center about the indigenous in Brazilian cities. It was used in a book for high school. So like the publisher reached out to me asking to use the content. So like be having our stories used for education purpose. I've been receiving a lot of contact for either students, grad students or undergrad students wanting to talk to us about our work in the environment. So I think that thinking on the long run, having our work used for education purpose is one of the best outcomes, and also to help justice for minorities.
I think Eduardo wants to reverse himself here.
No, just a thing. It's my opinion, of course, but I think our goal is to tell stories and make people know what's happening in the shadows, and make people, I mean, we are trying to bring information to people to take better choices. But it's not on our hands, the impacts, and shouldn't be our goals. Our goals is to tell stories, to follow up, and so on. So I think it's a wrap, you know?
Well, thank you all. This was an amazing conversation. What a fantastic group of journalists. I mean, when we were talking about impact, the impact on all this is just to get the truth out there. And then what happens as a result of that is out of our control. I was also it's just amazing this collection of people, and it's just an illustration of the fact that there are 8 million ways to tell the climate story, and they affect everything about every part of all of our lives. And so that really came home to me, whether it's housing or pollution or deforestation or corruption, the climate story is woven into all of this. And there's also so many different ways to tell these stories. So I found this really inspirational. I'm so glad they put us together. Thank you all for coming on a Saturday morning, and enjoy the rest of your stay.